counsel.
Morning, Your Honor. Carlton Smith for Larry Tucker. This case presents both a constitutional issue and an issue, even if there is no constitutional issue, of a violation of the Chenery Rule. I'd like to begin by talking about the constitutional issue. This case involves collection due process cases that were Congress in the late 90s heard much testimony about collection abuses in the IRS and decided that there needed to be some way to protect taxpayers by having a hearing. And this hearing was designed, was in part necessitated because Congress once before had stepped in the tax process in 1924 and said if there's going to be a deficiency in tax, which is an understatement of tax on a return, then we want to have a court. It was the Board of Tax Appeals originally, it is now the U.S. Tax Court, to step in and redetermine the correct amount of the deficiency. But and why is that important? Well, before the IRS can collect taxes forcibly, it must assess the taxes.
You agree, I take it, that there is review de novo of the IRS's assessment of tax liability. Is that correct?
Well,
whatever comes out of the IRS, from whatever subsection of the IRS, it gets reviewed, if the taxpayer objects, de novo by the tax court or a district court.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So as far as those decisions are concerned, it would appear that we don't have a problem.
Well, Your Honor, there is one situation though where the IRS appeals officers here can rule against the IRS with respect to an assessed amount, and the IRS has no right to appeal that portion. So there's a final ruling against the IRS that can happen at these hearings, and the IRS has no right of appeal to the courts. So in some sense, there's finality even with respect to those issues that would be reviewed de novo if there were not.
Okay. And for all of these people in the appeals office, is there anything to prevent the commissioner from moving particular people out of the appeals office?
No, there is not. If the commissioner could depopulate the appeals office, I guess. But
well,
then,
I presume.
Or assign them to other duties.
Right, or replace the
them
people
with,
who moved out with other people.
That is correct. At present, there is not any bar on the commissioner doing that. However, if a taxpayer then asked for a collection due process hearing, I don't know who would hold the hearing.
They would put other people in.
And put other people in.
Yeah, or have a smaller number of people.
It was not a question about totally depopulating the office.
Or have a smaller number of people. There's nothing that limits changes in the personnel or even the size of the number of personnel, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You could have one person doing it all if they could do it fast enough.
And the Supreme Court cases make pretty clear that removal power, of course, it's removal in the case of an officer, this is just reassignment, is a strong factor in ranking the position below the level of inferior officer, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think Your Honor may have presumed that these are, the commissioner has created these people. Congress has kind of blessed that they exist. Congress therefore has referred to them and expects some to exist.
Why isn't that an example of them being established by law? You have statutes here that create a right for a hearing, right? I mean, as you're saying, it's part of the reform. So a taxpayer, a disgruntled taxpayer, has a right to a hearing, and there's a statute that talks about the hearing and talks about the appeals officer.
Yes, so it says there'll be a hearing before the appeals officer. Right. I might point out in the Edmund case, there was no statute that said Edmund involved the Coast Guard Court of Military Appeals.
But my question is, why isn't that an example of being established by law? Were you going to answer that? I'm sorry.
I think they are established by law by virtue of Congress saying we want these hearings to be held by appeals. We want people in appeals, whether they're appeals officers or they have another title, officer or employee, to hold these hearings and make binding rules.
That last sentence sort of disclosed a perhaps weakness in your position, though, when you say officer or employee. The creation of an entity that is the appeals office does not suggest that everyone in it is an officer in that state, does it?
I would agree, Your Honor, but I would think anybody who is going to exercise the significant authority of conducting such a hearing.
Well, that's the issue, right?
Ruling must be appointed.
That's the issue, is whether these hearings are an exercise of significant authority, right? They're rather informal, aren't they? They can be done over the telephone. There's no taking of evidence, right?
Well, taking of evidence, there's no, people are not sworn in.
What I'm getting at is the Freitag factors.
Yeah, well,
these folks don't line up well with the seven Freitag factors.
Well, let me say, with respect to the formality of hearings, there were three hearings in Freitag that the court said everyone concedes these are final actions.
Right.
One of those was 7463 of the Internal Revenue Code, which provides for informal hearings in the tax court under such rules of evidence that are not the federal rules of evidence as the tax court should choose to follow. So, and relaxed rules of procedure. Those hearings, although the tax court itself does record them, they are, you know, people bring whatever they want to the court. The court is not required to apply the regular rules of the tax court there. And there's usually no post-trial briefing. So already
if we were to think that these officers don't measure up under the Freitag factors, is that the end of the inquiry, or is there more? Or are you really resting your case on the finality of the action by the...
Well, I'm somewhat constrained by this court's ruling in the Landry case that finality is extremely important, and so.
Constrained by that, or is that a boon?
Significance of the action, right?
Excuse me.
It has a great deal to do with whether the action in question, the actions, right, the powers are significant enough.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
If they're totally preliminary, it's hard to imagine them being adequately significant.
Well, I could argue that the tax court's rulings are preliminary in a deficiency case because, frankly, who's going to collect the deficiency? It may never be collected.
We're not talking about the tax court, are we? I mean, except insofar as its review power over the appeals over the IRS reflects on the powers left in the appeals office.
Mm-hmm. But the appeals officers hold the hearing.
Right.
They issue a ruling. The tax court, if it's not underlying liability issues, on all other issues, if the IRS wins the case in the taxpayer request review, the tax court reviews on abuse of discretion.
Right, right.
All the other
circuits. But let's focus on those, on the nature of the decisions which are reviewed that way, as opposed to the tenure of the employee, which appears to be zero. These are cases where an ordinary creditor could seek a lien or a levy, could it not? In other words, we have an established debt, or at least the solidity of the debt is subject only to the independent review of the tax court.
Well, an ordinary creditor, I would assume, would have to go through the courts to enforce whatever lien it
had. You'd have to turn the debt into a judgment.
Whereas the IRS is given a special privilege by Congress to say, you yourself can collect on the lien. Any property that is subject to lien may be levied with certain exceptions. So the IRS has been given the power not to have to go to court to levy. And that's...
It has a procedural advantage, which we'll assume is non-trivial. And then the standards as to whether there will be acceptance by the IRS involve the sort of mushy test involving, among other things, the assurance that the IRS will ultimately be able to collect the money, right?
Well, the appeals officer is instructed to weigh the IRS's right. need to collect revenue against the taxpayers
It sounds to me like an approximation, not identical, but an approximation of bargaining that could go on between any creditor and any debtor.
Perhaps even assisted by a mediator from some informal right. mediation
right.
service.
Right.
Well,
who might be playing a role similar to what the IRS employee or officer is playing here.
I agree that there can be negotiation because the appeals officer both acts sort of as the prosecutor and the judge in this.
They don't seem to be just sitting there taking evidence and issuing rulings like a judicial officer normally would be.
No, but they do. Maybe the court perhaps has not seen many of these cases. They begin with a letter from the settlement officer saying, mm-hmm. I have your case. Please submit a Form 433A.
Yeah, that title you just stated brings me to something else. How pervasive do you think this need to be treated as an officer is? We have at least three different kinds of employees or officers referred to in the briefs. How many of them are officers that have to be appointed?
Well, I would say under...
You just referred to the settlement officer. Are they included in your argument?
They were below, but now that I'm in the D.C. Circuit, the tax court has a special rule called Golson, which says that it follows the law of one particular circuit, and Landry is, of course, only this circuit.
What titles are they that are the officers that you say have to be appointed?
I will say, for purposes of this case now, it's just the team manager needs to be appointed.
Just the team manager.
Apparently, the team manager has the final say on whether the appeals officer or settlement officer.
Appeals officers are not officers that have to be appointed, right?
That's correct now, the way the IRS
is. The SOs are not. They're not, but the team manager is.
The team manager exercises the final decision here, apparently.
The team manager made a decision that somebody in the hierarchy of the IRS thought was too demanding or too imposing. Is there anybody in the hierarchy who could say, we're not going to enforce that, we're not going to put that lien out there, or we're not going to take that action?
There are, yes, later on, the people in the IRS could say we're not going to enforce
this harsh... Does that affect the finality of the decision for purposes of this analysis?
Well, I would say no, because the appeals, the team manager can also say, I'm going to enter into an offering compromise that does bind the rest of the IRS, or I'm going to rule for the taxpayer so that you can never collect this assessed amount. And it just goes back to the...
And before that decision is entered, does the officer, does the employee, officer, employee, whatever, need to get permission?
No, the team manager has delegated authority to sign offers in compromise. The judge below in the opinion indicates where it says that.
Mm-hmm.
So team managers act on their own on this, and there's nobody overruling them within the IRS. They're the last step before the courts, or before no one gets to go to court, before the IRS cannot ever enforce
it. I'm not sure if it has any bearing on the constitutional issue, but is it fair to say that it is only decisions preferring the taxpayer that are non-reviewable at the IRS?
That's correct, Your Honor, because the taxpayer could go... It's only if the taxpayer loses that the taxpayer will request an appeal, and then the IRS can't appeal. The taxpayer can appeal to the tax court, and the tax court will review for abuse of discretion.
I'm talking even within the IRS, is it the case that the only decisions by, let's just put it together as one entity, the appeals office, the only decisions by the appeals office that are not reviewable some other level of the IRS are ones in favor of the taxpayer?
That's correct. And the judge below was a bit surprised when the IRS came in and said, yes, we follow, if the appeals officer says you can't collect $1 billion deficiency that's been assessed, the IRS will not collect
Wouldn't
it.
Doesn't that go before Congress?
Excuse me?
Doesn't the IRS have to at least run settlements above a particular amount?
Only refunds.
On taxation?
Refunds below above a certain amount, but not deficiencies that the appeals.
Unless it's reduced to judgment.
Excuse me?
Unless it's reduced to judgment, then judgments over a certain amount are reviewed by Congress, are they not?
Your Honor, I don't know.
Okay.
I reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me ask you just before you go. I want to be sure that I understand what's at stake here. I understand the relief you want here is a reversal of the tax court, but the relief in the tax court has to do solely with the lien. You're not disputing liability or anything other than the lien itself. Is that
well, right? Yeah, actually, we're not even asking for the lien to be removed. One of the things that you are allowed to do during one of these conferences is propose the collection alternative. That's really what we wanted. And when the collection alternative, once we found out where the numbers came out, we said, we don't really want an installment agreement. We want an offer in compromise.
You're getting to the root of my question. I'm not quite sure what it is you want the courts to do for you in the end if you win on all of this. What is it you want the tax court to do if we send it back?
Well, I would like the tax court to send it back to the appeals office for an appointed person to rule on whether or not the offering
That's
compromise.
That's not really getting to the root of what I'm asking. Maybe I'm not making myself clear. What is it you want done? I'm not asking you who you want to do it.
What is
the result that you want out of the tax court?
I want the offering compromise my client submitted during the appeals conference, Your Honor.
You want that to be accepted?
I would like that to be accepted.
Does the tax court even have the authority to do that?
I believe it does. I've written an article saying it does. However, the tax court's never faced the
question. I don't believe articles are authority.
I know. There's no judicial.
The number of pages you have in here from the article by the law court.
Would it have to find the decision of the IRS an abuse of discretion to satisfy the OIC?
Yes.
Even if it did, could it order the entry of the offer in compromise?
There have only been about 10 cases, Your Honor, out of about 1,000 cases where an offer in compromise has been held to be improperly rejected. Some of those were procedural, and so the court just
did those send them back for actual acceptance of the offer in compromise?
No, Your Honor. A few of them ended with some were sent back because things were not considered and needed to be considered.
Yeah.
A few ended simply with a decision, and I'll give you an example, a case named Fowler, which is TC Memo 2004-something. I don't have it cited in here.
Send us the letter. You don't have it cited.
The decision in the Fowler case.
And I'm having a hard time still figuring out what you want the courts ultimately to do with your case.
It's not clear to me that.
I thought you were wanting the lien removed. But then when I asked you about it this morning, that's not what you want.
No, I don't want the lien removed because this offer would be paid over a long period of time, Your Honor, and the IRS should have a right to protect itself if my client should acquire property during the time he's paying the offer in compromise. But he wants an offer in compromise, which is one of the things Congress said he could ask for during that hearing. And
I don't know anywhere where Congress or the courts have said that the courts can order the acceptance of an offer in compromise.
Your Honor, I think it's contemplated by the statute, and let me explain why. The 7122 is the statute that does an offer in compromise. It has a provision that says if the IRS doesn't even rule on an offer in compromise after 2 years, it's automatically accepted. If the tax court is going to rule that the IRS did rule, it ruled incorrectly, you have no relief whatsoever. That would seem inconsistent with Congress saying, but if you didn't rule at all, you get the offer. So I think the tax court has the power. It has never faced the question. The few times it has entered a decision saying there was an abuse of discretion in rejecting this offer, such as in the Fowler case, I went and I got a copy of the decision.
If we didn't think we could do that,
then
what you would have to live with, right, is just a CDP hearing before an appointed officer, right?
Yes, and that new appointed officer might grant me the offer in compromise.
Right.
I'm sorry, how would this officer get appointed? We would
Well, at the moment, Your Honor,
we say the statute is constitutional if, but only if these people, I guess, team managers are given the appointment status of inferior officers.
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor, that the statute would be unconstitutional. A person exercising the power under the statute needs to be appointed. Now,
do they have to be confirmed?
Unfortunately, at the moment, both the IRS and I have been unable to locate any provision saying the Secretary of the Treasury may appoint whoever officer.
They have to be confirmed would be your answer to my question.
Yes. And but let me say, Your Honor, that would not be a big deal right now.
Yes, it would.
Because, well,
in which, now, in which the period of time would it would be?
In which country?
Yeah. You can't get anything confirmed right now, though.
Your Honor, there are two quick ways out of this. One is that President Obama could send a name over of one team manager right now, because only the tax court would not feel bound by this court's ruling anywhere else but D.C. D.C. has a population that is about 0.2% of the country. 0.2% of all CDP hearings would be fewer than 100, and a normal settlement officer deals with 100. I don't know how many in a year. I don't know how many. And the other way is that in 2008, there was a problem with the patent and trademark judges, and the appointment of the patent and trademark judges was being done by the head of the Patent Bureau, rather than the Secretary of Commerce. And when this problem arose, a bill was sent over to Congress. It was about a page long. It passed in both houses, saying, okay, the Secretary of Commerce can appoint the patent and trademark judges. That would be a fix. I would actually support such a fix, but just if there were a few training and experience requirements put in there.
I don't see anything in the Constitution about that.
Yeah, training and experience requirements are not a constitutional.
That would be quite novel.
Well, we don't have those for our jobs.
There are in the Internal Revenue Code requirements, for example, for the National Taxpayer Advocate to have certain experience requirements.
I understand, but it's not in the Constitution.
Okay.
There are in the Patriot Act requirements for U.S. Marshal now, but that has nothing to do with what we're doing here either.
Thank you,
counsel. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Teresa McLaughlin and I represent the commissioner. The commissioner's position is that the tax court was correct when it held that appeals officers, and that would include settlement officers and appeals team managers, are not inferior officers.
Even if they can end $1 billion levy without review, they decide it's over, can't be reviewed, that's not a significant responsibility.
No, we don't think it is a significant responsibility because what appeals is doing is merely looking at the kind of administrative collection determinations that rested with revenue officers of the IRS for decades. And no one would have suggested that revenue officers were exercising an office of the United States when they were deciding whether to go out and levy on property or file a tax lien. I mean, even a levy is only provisional. You can get the money back if you don't owe the tax.
Revenue officers in some circumstances have authority to reach decisions favoring the taxpayer, right? That is to say, there can be a, as I recall, a notice saying, we think you owe $1,000, and then negotiation proceeds, and at least in some circumstances, under some conditions, revenue officers can say, no, we agree with you, you don't owe anything. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, that...
Actually, revenue officers aren't deciding whether people owe the tax, but they are deciding whether to collect the tax. And what the CDP provisions do is sort of codified the existing collection appeals program that started in 1996, whereby the appeals function was already looking at decisions whether to lien or levy.
But I wanted to go back on the question of the actual, the tax itself, because both for various recollections, my recollection is that sometimes the IRS takes a position that you owe a certain amount, but then it is resolved at a moderately low level in the IRS, with the IRS in the end demanding less than it appeared to, and that's final.
Well, determinations whether someone owes a tax ordinarily come up through the examination division instead of the collection division.
Okay.
And it's, and
I don't care which division we're talking about.
And the appeals office looks at those determination, you know, if they're adverse to a taxpayer.
I'm talking about the other situation, that the case which counsel conceded. It's only in these cases where there's a decision in favor of the taxpayer that there's finality. So on the more serious issue, I would think more serious, how much do you actually owe, there are there not all kinds of situations where low-level people at fairly low level, moderately low-level people at the IRS make pro-taxpayer decisions that are final. Is that not correct?
Yes, that is true.
Yeah.
And so
that would all be, that would all have to be thrown out if the taxpayer prevails here.
Right, it's a reason why the determinations about liability are not exercising an office of the United States.
Right. I'm sorry. Say that again. Give me that sentence again.
Well, it's the fact that low-level people in examination can make a decision about liability that's favorable to a taxpayer would suggest that the fact that an appeals officer can make that same determination is not an office of the United States.
Does the government concede the proposition that this position is established by law in the sense required for it to be an officer under the Appointments Clause?
No, Your Honor. To the contrary, the commissioner's position is that the position of appeals officer, settlement officer, appeals team manager are not established by law.
Is the appeals team manager named in the statute at all?
No, Your Honor. Appeals team officers and settlement officers are never named in the statute.
How does something get established by law then? What does that phrase mean?
Well, it means
Here we have a statute that refers to them and talks about their duties. Why is that not adequate for finding that it's been established by law?
Well, because appeals officers are referred to only in a generic sense. The statute first assigns the conduct of CDP hearings to the IRS Office of Appeals, right, rather than to a specific person. And then it says, the first time it mentions an individual, it says it commits the conduct of the hearings generally to any officer or employee of appeals. Mm-hmm. So the use of the term office, and the statute does mention appeals officer.
You think they had in mind the constitutional phrase officer when they used that statute?
No, we don't, because if they meant officer in the constitutional sense, they would have been very unlikely to say officer or employee. Mm-hmm. And we think that this is an indication that Congress thought that...
Would you have a shorthand for me to shorthand way to explain what it means to establish that an office is established by law?
Well, it usually means that the duties, salary, means of appointment, and tenure.
Well, that's not what Freitag said. Freitag said established by law, and there was a statute that described that. So you think that's sufficient if you have a statute that describes means of employment, salary, and duties, that's being established by law?
It's not conclusive, but it's a start. And here,
for example, whatever statute creates the Office of Commissioner of Internal Revenue probably gives some names the office and gives some details not present here.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Or the administrator of EPA or
So you
judges of the circuit or something. Now, those are constitutional.
And historically, very few positions at the IRS are established by law within what we consider the meaning of the Appointments Clause.
Can you address the issue which I spoke with various counsel on, and that was the authority of the commissioner, or perhaps someone below the commissioner, to move people out of the appeals office? Are there any limits on that?
No, there aren't, because other than, I suppose, civil service limitations.
Right.
But
right.
Most employees at the IRS, the vast majority, are simply employees who are employed, not appointed.
And whose duties can be changed.
Yes, Your Honor. And going back to the significant authority point, even where there's a determination favorable to a taxpayer that a proposed levy may not go forward, that only lasts until circumstances may change. And the IRS is always free to issue another lien notice or levy to collect the tax. So it's by no means a blanket immunity from collection. And even where a determination favorable to the taxpayer has been made, the commissioner need not go forward with the levy. If, for example, if they discover that there's been a mistake in making the assessment, collection would not go forward, and they could still settle. They could still accept a part payment agreement or an offer in compromise. So the sense in which these determinations are final is very, very limited.
I guess, I mean, suppose you have an agency that regulates rates. It's normally those decisions are going to be time limited. I mean, that's really the point you're making here. I'm not sure if that's enough standing alone to reduce them below the level requiring either removability or appointment as an inferior officer.
Well,
I mean, no. Could the commissioners of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission be given a status, be able to do the things they do and not fitted within the Appointments Clause?
Well, I think that would be an entirely different situation.
They make these rate decisions, and then the utility can always file a new rate, which normally can take effect pretty quickly.
Well, even at the same time that this decision not to allow a levy to go forward or to require a lien notice to be withdrawn, these provisions don't affect the IRS power to offset someone's refund, so they can get the money that way. I think they would probably forbear while that is going on, while the CDP proceeding is going on. But this only relates to administrative collection techniques, and it doesn't affect whether it can ever be collected from the taxpayer, and so it's just too ephemeral to be the conduct to have the kind of finality that.
But the settlement would, right? I mean, they negotiate a settlement that's favorable to the taxpayer. That is the end of the matter.
Yes, that is the end of it. If it were a compromise, then that would be the end of it. And by the way,
And why isn't that significant authority exercised on behalf of the United States?
Well, because we don't think that the appeals officer has the authority to require the commissioner to enter into a compromise. All the appeals officer can do is say whether the levy can go forward or whether the lien filing can stand, not whether, so you can refuse the collection people the authority to go forward with the lien or levy that they want to do, but you can't make them accept an offer in compromise.
But once that's accepted by the appeals team manager, that's binding, right?
It is binding. That's
what I was getting at. Why wasn't that, and if that decision's made at that level, why isn't that significant authority being exercised on behalf of the United States?
Well, when appeals has a case for itself outside of CDP, it can settle a case conclusively in that way. But in a CDP proceeding, all it can do is either let the levy go forward or not, and let the lien filing stand or not. It can't require, if it thinks that there was an abuse of discretion in not accepting the offer, then all it can do is say you can't levy. It can't require the people who have the voice in whether to accept it to take it or not. All it can do is endorse or reject the proposed collection action that's at stake.
If they endorse it, what happens then?
If they endorse the collection action?
No, an offer in compromise.
Oh, then if the...
That's what we're talking about, isn't it? The offer in compromise?
That
was the subject now. What happens if they endorse it? You use the word endorse. I think we're trying to find out if this appeals level can bind the Treasury, bind the IRS by the acceptance of an offer in compromise.
Not in a CDP case. All they can say is if it didn't like the decision not to accept it, then the only thing it can do is say that the levy won't go forward or the lien has to be withdrawn. That's all they can do.
So they cannot order the acceptance of the office in compromise.
Right.
Now, you qualified your statement by saying not in the CDP case. Is there some other circumstance under which the appeals office could effect a binding acceptance of that offer in compromise?
If it's looking at the determination of liability outside of collection due process, you know, a case has come up through exam and it's...
No, I don't know. Leave the word you know out and go with things that we do know in this case.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but if a case is coming up through examination to the appeals function, when the taxpayer thinks they don't owe a tax outside of CDP, the appeals office has the authority to settle the case by way of an offer in compromise. But that's not true in a CDP proceeding.
I'm not sure, and there is some discussion of it in the briefs, how it affects the officer issue, if the appointments issue, if the particular employee or officer has officer-like authority in some circumstance, but not the one before us. Well,
the people in examination could also enter into a binding compromise.
Just to make sure, you accept Mr. Smith's contention, for which he had a Supreme Court citation, that we don't look exclusively to what happened to the taxpayer here. We look at whether the things that happened to him were done by either a suitably appointed officer or someone who did not require appointment under the appointments clause, right? Thus, we look at the entire functions. We're now focused exclusively on the team manager. We look to make sure that the team manager in all his or her activities is not an inferior officer requiring appointment of that sort, right?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because that was surprising to me.
Thank you very much.
Now, hold on just one moment, please. There's an issue that hasn't been discussed today that So to sideswipe the Chenery question with respect to the tax court's holding that the number used by the IRS officer or employee was incorrect, you stand on the proposition that there was not a departure from Chenery principles in that the tax court accepted part of what the IRS had done. Is that good enough, or should it have been sent back for consideration with the proper math? This is the day for bad government math, if you listen to the argument before us. But, is that good enough, or should it have been sent back for reconsideration on a proper mathematical calculation?
Well, I think that where there's a lesser included correct number, then it's within the tax court's province to just apply a harmless error rule.
That's what I'm asking you.
Yes.
What's the authority for that proposition?
That the mistake did not affect the outcome.
How do we know that where it might? I mean, it would seem possible that if the calculation had been the original $6 million and the, or whatever, $3 million, whatever it was, and the IRS officer employee had acted upon that proposition to reach her final decision, or his final, her, I think it was, final decision, that the tax court might want to send it back to look at it in light of $22,000 instead of $6 million. Would that not seem reasonable?
That's, yes.
Now, on the other hand, if it had been a calculation of $2,400 and it turned out to be $2,200, or $24,000 and it turned out to be $22,000, it would seem fairly logical the tax court could say, well, it couldn't matter, but here, what was it, a 2-to-1 difference in ratio? Or?
Well, it's a 22,000, and the taxpayer actually conceded before appeals that the amount of dissipated assets was, and the amount focused on by the tax court was about $14,900, and but I think the fact that the taxpayer conceded that $22,645 was dissipated assets would be enough to show that he wasn't prejudiced.
Thank you, counsel. We'll issue 2 minutes back to petitioner, our appellate for rebuttal.
Just to follow up on some of the past colloquy, if your view prevailed, then all these people in the IRS who have the authority to reach pro-pac taxpayer decisions on liability would a fortiori have to be named under conditions satisfying the appointments clause.
I don't agree, Your Honor. I think
Why not?
The court could issue a narrow ruling. Many of the people, first
narrow
of
and principled ruling?
No, well, even a principled ruling. There are no bright lines to figure out where you draw the appointments clause distinctions between.
If collection matters, we're so sensitive, as you would have us be, to appointments clause issues. I would think that for liability issues, tax liability, we'd have to be far more sensitive.
Your Honor, in Free Enterprise Fund versus the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, which is the most recent appointments clause case, Justice Breyer, writing a four-judge dissent, had dicta. He said, I think many people who are in the SES and the senior executive services are inferior officers. And I'm sure he was saying people who aren't even named in the U.S. Code. And the majority didn't have to address that question.
I'm not sure what we can get out of this sentence in a dissent.
Well, Your Honor, there are a number of cases. Willie is one of them.
That's not what the law isn't. Excuse me, go ahead.
Okay, well, there are a number of circuit court cases in the Third Circuit, in the Fifth Circuit, in the Sixth Circuit that say that Willie is the name of the most recent one in the Fifth Circuit. It involves the Department of Labor set up an administrative review board. The Secretary of Labor said, I don't want to exercise my statutory authority to review a bunch of things. Let's set up an administrative review board. Everybody agreed that the administrative review board was Well, the court held the Administrative Review Board could be set up by the Secretary of Labor, and that the people running it were inferior officers. There are a series of cases that have said that even though a person isn't named in a statute, if they exercise significant authority...
You're shifting away from the issue that I was focusing on, and that is the relationship between authority over these collection issues and exercising authority, and I underscore again, pro-taxpayer, on the actual substance of the tax.
Your Honor, I believe, although it wasn't necessary to our case, that other people in the IRS should be appointed. And just saying that some people haven't yet been doesn't answer the question. And I believe that some people in the IRS who are exercising supervision over revenue officers may need to be appointed.
It does come into our judgment of it in one way, and that is at least one argument in favor of one explanation for the appointments clause is the notion of getting a real focus at a very high level on people exercising such authority. And if there are thousands and thousands and thousands of them, there's not going to be that much focus.
Your Honor, I believe that the number of revenue agents is somewhere around 20,000, and the number of revenue officers is 10 or something, it's between 10 and 20. And they have bosses, and it could be that some of those bosses need to be appointed.
You're making the line awfully hard to draw.
Well, Your Honor.
It seemed like when we started on the ones that actually had something to do with this case, that I could look at your brief and you were saying that practically any decision maker in the office, using the term office in the sense of the agency that was created by Congress, had to be appointed. I didn't know at the end of reading your brief how I was supposed to determine which of them were to be appointed. I asked you today, and it gets down to the team leaders, but I'm not sure if we say, the team leaders have to be appointed, I'm not sure that changes the result in this case, and it certainly doesn't keep the IRS from saying, going in and saying, all right, we decided not to call anybody team leaders, we're now calling you all revenue officers, appellate stage, you don't have to be appointed anymore. I'm really not, you're not helping us draw that line very much.
Your Honor, Congress did name the appeals office, unlike a lot of
they named the office.
They named the office.
The word office, like the word is, may have more than one meaning. The office, to which I will repair after a while, has nothing to do with confirmation. It's a set of walls with books in it. Chambers, but also office. The office I hold is one that is contemplated in the Constitution and created by statute as a specific office that I hold. Now, I cannot find that kind of language concerning the team leader in a statute, certainly not the Constitution.
Your Honor, in Edmund, the Supreme Court case, the most recent, well, in 1997, the Coast Guard Court of Military Appeals judges had civilian, some of them were civilians. Mm-hmm. They were named in a statute, but there was no particular title to them. They were just civilian lawyers that the judge advocate general.
What did the statute say their title was? Did it say their title?
It doesn't say there is a, there
what
will
say?
Be.
What does the statute say? Does it say there are courts or does it say there are judges?
It was in part because there was nothing that says we, you know, how they're appointed that the Supreme Court let.
What does it say?
The statute. I'm reading from the Supreme Court's opinion. Each judge, this is 10 U.S.C. section. Article 66A, each judge advocate general shall establish a court of criminal appeals, which will be composed of one or more panels, and each such panel shall be composed of not less than three appellate military judges.
Appellate military judges.
Appellate military judges who are assigned to a court.
Position and gives us the title of the specific position that the appointments clause was held to apply to, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you have any comparable mention of team leader in the statute you're relying on today?
No, Your Honor, because okay. The IRS created it.
IRS
subsequently.
Is it possible to have an officer of the United States but exercising significant authority on behalf of the United States, but not have that position established by law?
No, but you're the established
why,
by law.
Why isn't it? Why isn't it?
Established by law doesn't necessarily mean that the statute says there's hereby established.
Right, are you writing established by law out of the test?
I was asking a different question. Yeah. Is it possible to have an officer of the United States, but not have that position established by law? Can the president give to someone significant authority to act on behalf of the United States, but yet it not be a position that's established by law, by Congress?
Well, when the president gives it, if the president has the authority to give it.
No, I'm not. That's a different issue.
This gets to an issue that is that the people on the Hill say the president's
czar's issue.
Czar's. I think that if significant authority is given to a person in the government, however labeled or not labeled,
then the appointments clause kicks in.
Then the appointments clause kicks in, and that's the view of the Department of Justice Office of Legal Affairs.
The established by law requirement is not a requirement. We don't have to go through that step.
Established by law has been interpreted by the courts not to require a reference in the U.S. Code.
Okay, Your Honor. Thank you, counsel. That case is submitted. Give us recess.
Don't worry, don't lock the door. I'll take care of it. Thank you.